Motopod, proudly supported by Roadskin, a UK label specializing in protective outerwear for motorcyclists. Modern biker clothing that you can wear all day long and engineered to save your skin. For the road, for life, visit roadskin.co.uk. Welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode 792 for November 23rd, 2024. I'm Jim McDowell. Richard Jowett is with me from across the pond. Rich, 792. We're eight away from 800 episodes. That's pretty crazy.
Getting close. Yeah, it's kind of end of term or end of semester for the American listeners show this time, isn't it? So
yeah,
looking forward to just wrapping this season up.
Yep, that's what we got to do here, guys. So we're going to go over some email that we got from the listeners. We're going to talk about the last race. We're going to talk about the testing that happened after that race. And then that'll be this show. And from there, well, we're going to see where it takes us to get us to 800. So with that, let's start off with an email. Now, this came from Jacob Brower. He's talking about the rules that are going to be in 27. He says, I don't understand the new 850cc displacement limit. We tried this before. To me, it seems very obvious how to evolve the rules. Simply continue to reduce the fuel capacity. Perhaps I should have asked, do the rules for 25 or 27 include further fuel limits? I do wonder if the power surplus with the 850cc's will be reduced enough to then reduce the aero drag appetite the bikes currently have, thus reducing aero and in turn, the undesirable side effects like tire pressure and general aero madness. So there is some niceties there about the show, which we appreciate, Jake. So let's get to this whole thing with the 850cc displacement. So as far as I know, and this could still possibly change, but the 850s are going to be allowed to have 22 liters of fuel, just like we have 22 liters of fuel right now. Now, this whole idea of going to 850 is a way to slow the motorcycles down. And yes, we've done this and we tried this before with 800s. And if you can remember the Hervé Poncerel Qatari interview that Rich did, Hervé says, well, we're going to 850s because of the bore. We force people into a different stroke, which is going to make a longer stroke for the bikes, which means you're going to get a torqueier engine so that they should have some power to drive off of a corner. And we shouldn't have the processional racing that we had in the 800cc era. Now, the 850s is the idea is that displacement is reduced because we got to reduce the speeds because even Qatar with like its 3 acres of gravel at the end of turn one have all got to a point where the bikes are traveling so fast, they will get to the hard objects, which we don't want to get to. So there isn't going to be a reduction in fuel capacity. Now, remember, 800s, at some point, we got those reduced down to 20. Well, I don't think the 800s were ever reduced by fuel capacity. But when we went back to thousands cc's after the 800s, we were allowed 22 liters. But then if you kept the factory electronics when we had the whole CRT thing, you were allowed to have, if you kept your homegrown electronic systems, you were got reduced down to 20 liters. They took 2 liters away from you. Ducati went with the Magneti Marelli. That's the standard system now. And they were given 22 liters to work with. You stop and think about that for a second, folks. Rich, help me out here with this. Do you guys sell soda pops in 2 liter bottles in the UK or in Europe? I don't think you guys do.
Not
I think it's
really.
An American thing. Yeah. So in America, they sell soda with 2 liter bottles. So it's 2 liters. So you would need 10 of those to get to the 20 liters. 11 of them get you to 22 liters. If you ever stood in the grocery store in the US and you had those 11 bottles, you think, holy heck, that is a lot, but it really isn't that much fuel. Anyway, side note, sorry. I diverged from where I was going. What would you expect from me, guys? There's always something else that's there. But the point being that when we went to thousands and if you had your own system, you got 20 liters of fuel. Well, the bikes were so thirsty that they had to do all kinds of crazy things to be able to get those bikes to the end. Like they had their own GPS systems on the bike. So the bike knew exactly where it was so it could lean itself out and then richen it back up when you got the corners, which that was what caused Jorge Lorenzo to have a huge high side at Laguna Seca once because the bike got confused where it was one time. There was was the problem where people would shortcut Magello and come back in. So then the GPS didn't know where it was and it got all confusing. And that really led to processional racing. Let's be honest, because everyone was concerned about fuel. Nobody could race to it. So eventually we got to these standardized electronics and you got back 22 liters. Okay, so now we want to try to slow the motorcycle down. So I don't think you can reduce the speed of the bikes and slow everything down by throwing a fuel limit on the bikes and saying, hey, look, you got to do this on 21 liters or on 22 liters. I don't think that's going to work. That's my take on it, because they're going to balk at it. First of all, the teams are going to balk because they're going to say, look, we can't go the distance that you want us to go without having this extra fuel. So that's going to be a non-starter there. If we want to reduce the speeds, we have two options, in my opinion. First one is we create a fuel flow limit. I guess there's three. There's three options, really. Sorry. First one, create a fuel flow limit. You say, look, you can only flow so many liters per second or whatever at a time. So then that way, you can't ever get any more power than anybody else. It's the idea that Formula One has. And quite honestly, it's one of the better things that Formula One has done. And was it 100 kilograms? Per something or some, I don't remember what it is. Either way. So the point of it is, it's like you can't violate this flow sensor that says you're flowing only at this rate. So I think that's a way you can slow the MotoGP bikes down if you want to. I think that's probably the better way. The other way is going to be with the alternative fuels. Okay. So if we're going to go to carbon neutral fuels in 2027 or near carbon neutral fuels in 2027, right off the bat, they're predicting about a 15% reduction in the amount of power that the bikes are going to make because the fuels won't have the octane that's necessary for it to work. Now, eventually, these fuels will come around and like anything else, they're going to work on it, develop it, and they're going to get right back to where they were, have that octane, and they're probably going to go just about as fast. So it's not a permanent solution, but it is a way to sort of in the interim slow them down. I think the best way to slow these motorcycles down is going to be a more standardized aerodynamic package that each bike has to run. So we can't get crazy with it. We have a set of wings on the front and that's about it. And we very much define where you can and cannot put anything else on that motorcycle. But along with that, you have to make tires that are harder. Now, I know what you're thinking. They need to have a soft tire to be able to have some grip and some feel. And you can't go out there in a ball bearing hard tire and race around and have any kind of competitive racing. I get that. Well, let's think about it this way. This is just an example. If we went to Jerez and at Jerez, Michelin brought a soft rear and a medium rear. Those were your choices. And they had a medium front and a hard front. Okay. Well, what I want to have happen, say, the next time they go to Jerez, is Michelin is not allowed to bring that soft tire again. The softest tire they can bring is that medium. Therefore, they would have, as a rear, they'd have a medium and a hard. That's your two choices. So you're letting them have a decent tire to run on, but it's not the fastest tire that we've seen this year. Because there's a lot of races where they have the softs and they use them and they're really fast on them. But their backup was a medium, which is just about as good, but would have a little more longevity to it. If you do that and you incrementally kind of manipulate that sequence of tires, the guys are going to go slower. Now, my personal take is I don't care if we ever set another track record for how fast somebody got around the track. I understand why we want that because it's a headline grabber and people have an attention to it. But to me, I want to see closer racing with three or four guys battling for the podium positions than I do wanting to see people go super fast for one lap. So that's all that part of it. Now, as far as the aero appetite and stuff with the 850s, yeah, they're not going to be able to pull that aero through. If you don't have the horsepower to pull the aero, then you can't put as much aero onto the bike. I would assume, giving that they're going to trim the bikes out a little bit, give them a little less aero, which should give us better front tire issues and maybe reduce this pressure problem that's going along with it. But I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't have that big of an effect on it. So with that covers Jacob's email. Great email, Jacob. Love it when you send them in, and love it when all you guys send something in for us to talk about and have our opinions on it. Rich, is there anything that you want to add to Jacob's email?
Just a couple of things, Jim, that sure. Just occurred to me whilst you've been doing your sort of expert bit, sort of technically given your view on it. I mean, one of the big complications with reducing fuel is that would not work in the sprint.
Sure.
So you have to have a solution to this problem that works in both the sprint and the main race. So fuel flow would be the obvious way to do that. Again, I'm going to have to throw the ball back to you on this one, Jim. I think part of the reason for the 850 and the way that they've constructed the rules around bore and stroke is also so that we don't fall back into what the big problem in the 800 formula was, which was just sending the revs, into the blue sky. You will be limited in revs, I think, here. So they can't just claw back lap time and power
That is true.
at the expense of fuel consumption, it's true, but by doing that route. So I think they have thought about this very carefully in terms of the 850 rule. But you could call it a slightly, I don't think I wouldn't class it as a cynical take particularly. I just think it's a kind of realistic take is that we talk often and we've talked recently about the need for the manufacturers that are pumping, millions of dollars or euros, pounds, whatever it is, into this sport. They have to have some trickle down effect in terms of a return on that investment. And I think if you look at the way bike sales are going in terms of road usage, liter bike sales are tanking just about everywhere, certainly in Europe, and I believe that would be the case in America, Jim, as well, North America.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not really 100% on that one because who can tell nowadays what year motorcycle anybody is on? But yes, bike sales are down and the displacements that are selling are more adventure tourer, those kind of motorcycles here in the
Smaller
US, at least.
capacity
Smaller
bikes,
capacity,
things that use less fuel, et
yes.
cetera, because everybody has targets to meet. Whether you believe those targets are valid or the right thing to do, that's a different discussion. We won't stray into that area. But it strikes me that it was sensible for the manufacturers to look at 850 as a kind of a midway kind of size of engine that might have practical benefits in terms of road usage in various different genres of road bike, whether it's, as you say, adventure bikes, long distance tourers, scratchers, whatever it is. The interesting thing for me going forward as we look down the road to say 2030 and beyond is what the implications of all this are for things like Moto2, because that's already what 6.75 is it or something like
It's
that.
seven six
Oh, sorry,
five, I believe.
7.65. I'm getting my numbers around the
Yes.
wrong way.
Yeah.
So there's going to have to be some sort of an adjustment, I think. And at the same time, obviously, there's been this ongoing discussion about needing to put the size of the Moto3 engines up so that we don't have quite such crazily close pack racing going on. So there's a lot of interesting things going on. Never mind before you start talking about World Superbike
Oh, yeah.
and World Supersport. Clearly, there is going to have to be an adjustment to the way that those bikes are configured technically as well. So yeah, I mean, it's a kind of an interesting time. I kind of sensed a little bit from Jake's email, rightly or wrongly, and I'm a little bit fearful when they drop capacity down because you immediately think, oh, it's going to make things slow and boring. And certainly the 800s was not a golden era, but I think the mistakes that were made in the formulation of that technical rules package have been very actively avoided in this 2027 rule set. So let's be hopeful about that. And as you say, Jim, I couldn't give a toss if they went a second quicker anywhere ever again. I would rather see them going 5 seconds a lap slower and racing much more competitively throughout the field, not just at the front. So I think, and I hope that that is what we will ultimately see. But obviously, the fear is that there's some very clever minds up and down the pit lanes, and they will always find a way to get the bikes quicker again and to come up with whiz bang solutions that kind of claw things back or release new genies out of new bottles, which become a problem later on. But for
Right.
now, at the risk of upsetting Alan, but personally, I'm happy to see the shapeshifters go. I don't think they're really sensible devices that you can make the safety argument as we've done many, many times, and they have no road application usage whatsoever. So those will be quite significant, I think, in terms of slowing the bikes down. If they're electronic, that would be different, but they're not. They're mechanical. So that's the big distinction for me. So yeah, that's my kind of take on it.
Yeah, in thinking this, and this is only because I just recently saw this as well. If you're at 850 for a MotoGP bike, a 765, 769 Triumph 3-cylinder is dangerously close to that capacity. I think the Triumph engine, which I love the 3-cylinder, should be closer to, say, a 620, maybe a 625 size. I think that would be better, but I would like to keep the stroke that they run now the same and then just decrease the size of the piston. So it's a very torquey engine. If I'm writing the rule book, I would love, because Honda just announced a 3-cylinder, 300 cc forced in. Induction, forced, yes, forced induction motorcycle. It looked cool. It's very small, 300 cc's. Could we make that the Moto 2 bike? It worked that idea, right? I think forced induction might be a way to sort of get everybody from the one cylinder 250s to a twin slash 3-cylinder 300. And if we want a little, if it's not fast enough, how about a little forced induction on it? just because, right? It's
Yeah.
just different then, right? So then I think you don't have a pack race as that goes,
Yeah, I mean, like it or
perhaps.
loathe it, we do have to extract more from less. I mean, in all sorts of different walks of life, that's kind of what we're being told we have to do. Again, we could argue till the cows come home, as we say in the UK, as to the veracity of some of these arguments and the merit of some of these arguments. But it is an undeniable fact that car manufacturers, bike manufacturers, certainly in the sporting arena, they're being asked to be more fuel efficient, use less impactful fuels in terms of environmental effects. Again, I'm a bit skeptical about some of this stuff, but we won't go down that road just at the moment. So this is what we're facing. But if at the end of it, the clever rulemakers can design the rules in such a way that we get good racing, irrespective of the fact they might be going a tad slower, I don't have a problem with it. Provided the bikes look nice and they sound all right. I'm not kind of a hater of Moto E. Some of the racing's been actually really, really good. But for me, a big part of it, because I'm old fashioned, is kind of the noise and the smell and the feel, particularly when you're trackside. That visceral thing, if you lose that, you lose a lot. So whilst electric bikes will play a role in racing going forward, I think I just understand the need to rein these things in a little bit for a variety of different reasons. So yeah, I'm looking forward to the 850s, Jake, and hopefully it will deliver up good racing and it won't repeat the mistakes that we've seen in the past.
All right, let's move on to some news. There's only two things we want to cover real quick here. Dennis Foggia is going back to Moto3. He's going to Aspar. Thought that was really interesting that Foggia just, he said he knew it was going to be hard to go to Moto2, knew that it was going to be difficult, didn't think it'd be this difficult for those 2 years. And he wants to go back to a winner, which can't really argue with him on that one.
Yep.
And Scott Ogden has now gone to the CIP Green Power. It will be on a KTM, and he will team with Noah Detweiler. So Scott Ogden still stays in the paddock, which is good for you Brits, Rich.
Yeah, I'm particularly pleased, obviously, with a slight national bias. It must be divulged, but not won't come to a surprise for anybody. But I'm pleased for Scott. I mean, he's done good things on the MLAB bike. I think, without hating on MLAB, they haven't been running bang up to date equipment. So, and Scott is one of the taller riders. And so perhaps it'd just be interesting to see him on the KTM rather than the Honda and see, how he fares, because he's put in sporadic but very good performances. Obviously, he's got the talent. He wouldn't be in Moto3 in any team if he didn't have talent. And he's had good form at times. And so, and that's a good little team, that CRP Green Power team. So interested to see what he can achieve there next year.
Yep. All right. Let's get into the actual race action that happened at Barcelona. Again, this last race was at Barcelona as opposed to Valencia because of all the flooding that happened there. There was a, they called it the Solidarity GP. It was great to see a lot of people that had come out for it. There was all kinds of donations and things that were done there. So they really did try to do something for the people who had been ravaged by this natural disaster.
Yep.
So in Moto3 qualifying, in the first qualifying session, Suzuki, Bertoli, Furuasato, and Yamanaka all get through. Furuasato gave it one last gasp and he got in with one last great run. As we went to the second qualifying session, Alonso goes out and basically he's just under the track record. Okay, fine. Everybody else is playing catch up for all of that. Fernandez had a crash at turn five. That is a very tricky turn. Everyone seems to have a rough go of it there. But Alonso would take the pole position. That would give him his seventh pole position, his seventh Tissot watch, which meant the pressure was then off of him because he now had a watch for his last crewman. They all have a watch courtesy of Alonso. Vier would start second, then Ortola, Piqueras, Holgado, Vinetta, Fernandez, Burisato, Rolstein and Suzuki made the top 10. From there, we will get to the Moto3 race. Now, Rossi had a double long lap penalty that he was going to have to take. It was for slow riding at some point during the weekend or whatever, but we would see what was going to happen. 18 laps, Alonso with a hole shot at the very beginning, followed by Ortola, Horgado, Vier, and Piqueras. Nepa was down at turn four, and Lunetta was involved in that incident, which he basically just threw it up the inside and used Nepa for a berm. So he got a double long lap penalty going into it. Munoz had a great start as well because he moved up to fourth from his 12th place position. Holgado charged to the front, followed by Munoz, Fernandez, Alonso, Ortola, and Piqueras. And he would hold that position for a few laps until eventually Fernandez got by on there. But then Holgado and Fernandez would battle back and forth for a few laps, trying to decide who had more muscle. But the muscle came in the way of Ortola because we've got that kilometer long straightaway. Everybody was just moving around in the draft. So it was just weird that everybody was just all over the place in this one. But Ortola would go to the front for a little bit. Munoz was there. And then they touched at turn five. And that kind of skittled the pack a little bit as everybody tried to get around what had gone on there. But Fernandez was still leading, and Alonso had got himself to second with about 8 laps to go. Typical ride by Alonso, the pattern of events there. Ortola got a track limits warning thereafter. But then, with about five to go, Alonso got to the front with Holgado behind him. Furusato got a track limits warning with about four to go. At three to go, Munoz had got back to the front with Alonso. They were had elbows out at turn one. They were going at each other. Alonso would fall then to fifth as he had a rough go there. So with three to go, Alonso is now back to fifth. Ortola then nerfed Alonso wide at turn four. So Alonso was getting beaten up by the gang here with about three laps. I think they'd realized that Alonso's game plan was always to be there at the end. But hey, people, you got to rough the kid up maybe. So, okay, we're going to try that tactic. That tactic did fail because Alonso would go past everybody on a brilliant last lap to win the race. So Alonso would win, giving him seven straight wins in a row. That was a record. Basically, Alonso hasn't lost since we did the flyaway races after Misano. Incredible, to be honest with you.
Very incredible.
Yeah. Helgardo would get second place on the podium. Piqueras would get that final step up onto the podium. Jose Antonio Rueda, who we didn't talk about at all, just sort of appeared at the very end and got a fourth. Then Yamanaka, Munoz, Forsato, Rolstein, Ortola, Vire at 10th. Vire had a horrible race. I think something was wrong with his bike. In the post-race pictures of Vire in the box, he very much would be like throttle on and, the gesture of there's nothing there. Not sure what happened. Could have been something clogging an airbox. It could have been a leak in the airbox. It could have been anything. Who knows what was going on there? But then Fernandez, Kelso, Suzuki, Almanza, and Bertelli would be the last point scorer with that one. Absolutely incredible season by Alonso. An incredible run of form by Alonso to win those seven races in a row. The kid's a talent. I don't have anything more to say about Alonso. Do you, Rich? I mean, I don't know. Do you have a thesaurus for great? I really don't know what to do.
Well, I mean, we have run out of superlatives, as are most people, really, when describing the kid, really. And so I won't bore people by kind of doing my loving on David Alonso for this race. I mean, the simple fact of the matter is that he was able to win at will, really, in the second half of the season, wasn't he? I mean, that was his 14th win out of however many races there were.
20 races.
I think it was 14 anyway for the season. And as you say, seven on the bounce. The class level that he was at was so far beyond everybody else. And there are some very good riders in Moto3, let's not forget. So my question to you, Jim, is he better than Pedro Acosta was at this stage? Because that's the only comparable, I would argue, talent that's come up through in recent times. And admittedly, Acosta was only, what, 3 seasons ago, would that have been? 3 or 4? Different bike, different team, different season. It's not totally comparable, but I mean, I've got a view on this, but I'm interested in yours.
So I'm going to say yes, that he is better than Acosta, but I'm going to put an asterisk on what Jim said. To me, I think that the overall level of riding talent in Moto3 when Acosta did his deal was a little better than the overall talent we have now in the group. Because, and I say that because really, the top guys like Helgardo never had any consistency to be at the front. He had big stretches where he was nowhere. Piqueras had a rough start learning the bike because he's the rookie to the class, but his second half of the season was really pretty strong. Rueda had flashes of brilliance, but never did put it all together. So, with that said, Alonso, I think, might be the better rider because Alonso won races from way farther back than what Acosta did in his time, but it doesn't really matter. They're both supreme talents. I mean, we're talking about two kids that I think are alien level style motorcycle racers. Alonso, because he decimated a class that is an axe murderer class that usually has 13 different winners in a season. For him to dominate as he did was absolutely impressive. But Pedro Acosta got onto a gas-gas MotoGP bike and for a rookie did incredibly well with that system. I mean, he outrode, outpaced the guy who knows that KTM better than anybody, Brad Binder, and Jack Miller, and shaded his own teammate, Augusto Fernandez. And Augusto is a Moto2 world champion, right? So, yeah. Acosta didn't win a race. Yes, he didn't do a Marquez and win a title in his first season, but There's something special about a Costa on a MotoGP bike. Do not misunderstand that. So that's where I'll leave it. What do you think, Rich? Few questions, so you have some answer.
It's a hard one to judge at this point in time. And as you quite rightly point out, Jim, Acosta was stellar in Moto3, pretty stellar, if that's not a kind of a stupid way of putting it, but was very good in Moto2. Did he have one season in Moto3 before he went up to Moto2? I think he did, didn't he? Did he win it?
Well, yeah, he was champion as a rookie.
Champion in his rookie season. So, whereas this is Alonso's second season in Moto3, full season.
Yes.
So, you have to balance it a little bit there. He's had a bit more time in Moto3, has David Alonso. But I think possibly the racecraft of David Alonso, on the evidence of what we've seen so far, is better is probably not quite the right word. Perhaps a bit more impressive in terms of the way he's handled himself this year. And, you can't really compare him, I suppose, given it was me that asked the question, but to Acosta, because Acosta's gone through Moto2, done really well, won the championship in his second season, and you might argue should have won a race in Motegi in MotoGP this year, threw it away. But, he's a rookie. That's what happens when you're a rookie. You find the limits, and you find that often by exceeding the limit. So on a bike that is well known to be quite a tricky bike to make it go fast consistently. So, I mean, the jury is out, but so far, I think Alonso in Moto3 terms is, for me, just probably shading it, but does have the benefit of the second season. But again, doing my broken record routine, how quickly, because I don't think he won't adapt to Moto2. It's really a question of how quickly will he adapt to Moto2, because Acosta did it very, very quickly. They went on a kind of a crashing spree in that first third of the season in
Broke his
Moto2.
femur.
Then he broke his leg away from the track in a motocross accident, which kind of impacted the second half of his season. But by the time he had his second season in Moto2, Acosta was untouchable. So the question is does it take Alonso one or two seasons to replicate that? I suspect he'll go through the first season struggling a little bit, and then season two, yeah.
Let's bring that back up because I've got times from Jerez for Moto2 and Moto3.
Okay.
We'll add a little more there. How's that for
Okay.
context?
Yeah, good.
So, sorry, Rich.
Well, all I was going to say was I'm clinging on to the conversation, not clinging on, just fascinated by the conversation and the answer that Hervé gave at Silverstone when I interviewed him about this idea that Alonso makes it to MotoGP in time for the 2027 rule set, because he's got a couple of years now to learn and then win. And by win, I mean the championship in all probability in Moto2, ready for jumping on the 850 in 27. And that is a mouth-watering prospect.
Oh, yes, it is. Him versus Acosta is going to be a very mouth-watering prospect.
Yeah, because there's every reason to believe that Marc Marquez, and possibly even, like your Bagnaia and your Binders and stuff, they might not be around anymore at that stage. I mean, Marquez, who knows? I mean, these guys do ride on a long time now. We're still talking, what, two full seasons to go and then a
Yes.
big change. So, yeah, Acosta might be kind of king of the hill by that stage.
Could be. So let's go back to Moto3. Let's look at the championship. We obviously know that Alonso is world champion, but the question was who's going to finish second in the world championship? Helgado, via having that second place and Vier's 10th, gave Helgado the second position, and Vier was third. Otola is fourth. Munoz was fifth, then Fernandez, Rueda, Piqueras, Kelso ninth, and Furusato has 10th in it. So your top four are all going to Moto2.
Yeah.
So that's sort of how it's supposed to be. You do well, you're there, you graduate, you move on. So with that is everything about Moto3 from that weekend. Let's go to Moto2 now, Rich. If we go to the qualifying on there was really nothing that big of a deal in the first qualifying session. It was pretty lackluster, but Lopez, Senna, Agius, Arenas, and Masia all got through. He just did it with a great last lap to get in, really. So he threw one in there at the end, a real flyer. On the second qualifying session, Audiger was down at turn 14. He just touched that curb on the inside and just lost the bike. It was very bizarre that he did do that. Navarro was down, and only 10 riders had set a lap time halfway through due to yellows. Like, so many people got laps just scrubbed off the board. Arenas crashed at the very end as well, but Aaron Canet would take the pole position, followed by Gonzalez, Van de Gerberg, Dixon, Ayagura, Marrera, Salach, Vietti, Navarro, and Senna Agius. So it was a very mixed up qualifying session for the Moto3 guys just because of the yellows and everything else that was going on around. But we'll get to the race. Now, Audiger had to serve a long lap penalty that he had from his indiscretions, and I think in Buriram. So he still had to take that because he hadn't gotten there yet. But when we started this one, Gonzalez took off with a hole shot. He would get out front. Canet, he kind of went backwards really quick. Dixon was way up there as well. He had a great start, but I think was wide on one. And then he was, out like in the penalty lane coming back in. There was then a high sides. Who was it that high side at Rich? They had on the change of direction there. Or was it an almost high side? It's been a bit since I can't remember. I don't have it quite
I can't
right.
remember too much. It was such a boring race. I didn't really take much
Oh
of
yeah,
it
it
in, to be
was.
honest.
The first lap was exciting. I was trying to do as much as I could to excite the first lap antics of what had gone on. But essentially, Gonzalez, Onchu, Salach, Marrera, and Van de Gerberg were all sort of in the front. Then Dixon and Navarro were then down at turn five. So Dixon was gone at that point. That was just tragic for him. But Van de Gerberg was into the back half of Vietti, and he wiggled out, and they got a crash there, and they were at turn one. And I don't know. Xander Berberg, I don't know what he was thinking. He was just all over the place there at the beginning. It was like everybody decided they want to just detach their brain and become Moto3 kids again or something. I don't know what was going on. Onchu was really lucky to stay on because Van de Gerberg had touched Onchu, and Onchu then was able just to keep a hold of everything. Again, these were like the only laps of chaos that happened were these first two laps. And that was pretty much it. Because from that point on, Canet went to the lead. He was followed by Gonzalez. He was followed by Aigura, Marrera, Agius, and Salach. And that sort of just kind of kept the thing there. Now, Onchu had a long lap penalty for track limits with about 13 to go. But the front guys don't really change. They're in their same positions, and it just doesn't really matter. Nobody could really do anything except for Marrera got by Aigura, but Aigura would go right back against him. And then basically, Gonzalez was starting to close in a little bit on Canet, but Canet had everybody covered here. Marrera did go by Aigura at one, but then Aigura went back by Marrera at turn 10, which was a great move on the last lap to get it to where Canet would then win. Gonzalez would be second on it, but Marrera got onto on the last lap, last turn, sort of a Rossi-esque thing, and would take that final podium spot, which is great for Marrera. Then Aigura, then Salach, Garcia, with a top six. I mean, Garcia finally had a race that was worthy. Then Guevara, Lopez, Audiger, Chantra, Ramirez, Agius, Arbolino, Masia, and Darren Binder. This one, wow, was a snooze fest, Rich. I really don't know what to tell anyone. We were just watching Canet basically race himself the whole time after the chaos that happened. I can't say that the racing between Aigura and Marrera was not fantastic. It was back and forth. It's what you were looking for out of the race, but there was nothing in the middle. The first two laps are great, and the last three laps are great. And anything else in between was follow the leader processional. It was a really horrid Moto2 race. I don't think Barcelona creates that great of racing. The long straight sort of takes everybody away and separates them a little bit. You have turn five, which is tricky, which if anybody crashes there, holds everybody else up and lets the pack sort of expand, and they never really do ever come back together again. But we'll look at the championships. Of course, Aigura is your world champion, but Canet would finish second in this. Gonzalez would go to third in the championship. Sergio Garcia, the runaway leader for the first half of the season, would eventually finish fourth in this championship. Do you put Garcia as your favorite for the championship next year, Rich?
No, I don't actually.
Okay.
I mean, this is probably a discussion for a different show, but
It will be, but I just thought I'd ask.
I mean, he will go into next season as one of the favorites. But the question is, although it was a solid finish in this final race, but it's been a horrible second half of the year for whatever reason. And, form is always difficult to change when you're on that kind of run. So he needs a strong start to next year. But for me, Canet is the impressive guy here. Outside of Aguirre, I mean, as you said, Jim, that Aguirre Marrera fight was quite entertaining, but Aguirre won the championship and didn't want to have a crash because he was out on a MotoGP bike 2 days later in the test. So, but fair play to Marrera. First podium in Moto2. Been quite impressive this year. I think this is his rookie season. So he ends the season strong. I mean, there was some interest there, but the cynic in me says they kind of ended up at Barcelona. Obviously, they couldn't go to Valencia. We've spoken about that, obvious reasons. But, the big gala dinner was planned, prize presentation was planned weeks in advance to happen wherever it happens in Spain. Maybe that was in Valencia. So it didn't really warrant them racing somewhere other than in Spain. And Barcelona for me is one of the Spanish rounds that I personally would drop because there's too many rounds in the Iberian Peninsula anyway. To me, it never really delivers up great racing. And I do have a lot of data from there. So that was never going to lead to a fantastic weekend of racing. And I think that's generally what we saw. We haven't even come to MotoGP yet.
No,
So
man.
nothing much more to say really, other than Canet has had a very impressive season. I mean, he was the perennial second place finisher, if we remember, had his first win in Portugal this year, got that kind of monkey off his back, and this is his fourth win of the season. So again, and by far the second half of the season has been the best for him. So he will head into next year in the same team, same crew, very, very confident, I would imagine, and rightly so.
Yep, I agree with you. Audegar would be fifth in the championship, but he's off to Ducati. Lopez, then Vietti, Dixon. Roberts falls all the way to ninth, but he didn't race the last three races because he had the broken navicular bone in his wrist. And Arbolino is 10th. So gonna be interesting next year when the Moto3 guys that we know are going up get into this mix. So we're there. We'll have to watch that space, see what happens.
We will report when we hear. Yeah.
All right, so let's go to MotoGP because that is where, in theory, all everything was to play for, right? Because we still got Bagnaia and Martin. They still have to decide who's going to be world champion with all this. But in the first qualifying session, it was the KTMs minus Acosta, the Hondas minus Zarco, and the Yamahas were there save for Rins. He had gotten through, which is kind of crazy when you think about it. So through all that, Moreira and Raul Fernandez were leading for the two spots to get in at halfway. After that, Miller, who was trying to get through but fell, but Morbidelli and Quartararo got through into that Q2 session. So in the Q2 session, it was a pack of riders that left altogether. It was like the Moto3 guys had showed up in MotoGP. Everybody just went out altogether. It was like a huge pack. They all went out together. Alex Marquez was down quickly at turn five right off the beginning. Halfway, Bagnaia, Marc Marquez, and Martin, and Quartararo. I was like, whoa, that was just, great effort by Quartararo just to even be that close. I mean, it was amazing he was that far up there. The big question that happened in this session was, did Bagnaia actually change the rear tire? It looked like he'd come in and said, no, I think I'm okay with this one. I had the impression he changed it. Michelin data said it already had like four laps or five laps on it, and he went back out on it. I never did get a definitive answer, didn't hear a definitive answer. I don't know if you know, but I don't think he went out on a new tire. I think he was out on his original tire, wasn't he?
No, I think they did
He
correct it
did?
midway
They
through
did
his
it?
run
Okay.
to say that no, actually that data is wrong. He did change. So I'm pretty sure he was on a fresh tire.
Okay, so Bagnaia was on a fresh tire. Okay, cool. So at that point, Bagnaia, Marquez, and Morbidelli were all there. Now, Martin did screw up turn one, and he kind of ran wide on that one. So when it all came down to the end, Bagnaia was the quickest person, followed by Aleix, who is just sort of like the master of Barcelona, right? He just is. Then Marc Marquez, but Martin was fourth. Perfect position here for him. Then Morbidelli, Acosta on the front two rows. Then Vinales, Bastianini, Bezzecchi on the third row. Then Quartararo, Marquez, Alex, that is, and Zarco on that fourth row. So the qualifying was kind of what you expected. Martin did what he had to do. I thought Martin would have been maybe just a smidge higher. He did have that little small problem. And you wondered out loud, at least I did, is that the crack in the Martin armor that Bagnaia is looking for? Because Bagnaia comes into this 24 points behind Jorge Martin. And then we got to go to the sprint, right?
Yep.
So we look at the sprint here. It was interesting. You had Martin going with a medium front and a soft rear, and you had Bagnaia on a hard front and a soft rear. So at least they were on the same rear. The front tires are basically the same. It's just a bit of feel. The hard's a little bit better for the hard braking at turn one. So Bagnaia is a late breaker. So it made a lot of sense to me that those guys would be off slightly in that respect. So the maths are real simple here. Martin only has to score two more points than what Bagnaia scores, and he will be world champion. So basically, all he's got to do is finish second throughout this or whatever. And he's basically going to be, Martin just really needs to just stay on the bike, right? He can't afford a crash, but he's pretty much okay. So at the start, Bagnaia just got out of there, but Bastianini led for a little bit there. But then Bagnaia got back through again. Martin was in real deep at the first turn. He kind of went just a little bit wide. Bagnaia then went under him. That's how Bagnaia got the second. And then it's Acosta and Marc Marquez. They kind of come out of there within a little bit of a tangle that caused Acosta's whole entire front fairing to be ripped off of his motorcycle.
Very, very weird thing to see happen. I mean, the whole thing came
Yeah.
off, didn't it?
The whole thing in one big old chunk just went right out of there. Again, you got all these little flip up and winglets things that are on the back of the bikes that's got to go away. They will in 27. They're just catching on to things and flicking things off. So, again, when that big of a piece left the bike, I thank God it was in a corner and it didn't stay on the bike and then blow off on a straightaway where it could have injured Acosta or injured any other rider that was going by. Again, aerodynamics might be the fastest thing, but oh man, I just don't want to see anybody get smacked by a bit of carbon fiber like that. I really don't. And thankfully, nobody did. So we're all good there. Bagnaia would instantly go to the front with Bastianini behind him, then Martin, then Morbidelli. Sorry, now I got them mixed up again. Can't get
Oh
it.
no,
Can't get this straight.
it's the new thing.
Yeah. Imagine when Morbidelli and Marrera are in the MotoGP together. We're really going to
Oh,
have fun. Like I have fun with all the Fernandezes.
lordy.
Anyway, then it was Alex Marquez and then his brother, Mark. Martin would make his way to second. Bastianini then got by Martin at turn one. Then Martin went back by Bastianini at turn one again. It was just draft me, draft you, see who was going to be there. With five to go, Bagnaia, Martin, Bastianini, Alex Marquez, Aleix there, and then Morbidelli. Two to go, Bagnaia is still out front. Martin's still second. Bastianini, nothing's really changing here. But where Alex Marquez would be wide at 10, and then he would be behind Aleix. The race finishes with Pecco Bagnaia winning the sprint, Bastianini second, Jorge Martin third, Aleix Espargaró, then Alex Marquez, Morbidelli, Marquez, as in Mark, Bezzecchi, and Binder taking a point. The result of this, basically, it's a nothing. It's Martin's still in the driver's seat. He's only lost 5 points, right? So it's a 19-point lead now that Bagnaia has. So he needs help, and he needs a lot of help, really, because Martin could finish, I think, like eighth or better, and he was still going to be a world champion. We got to the race. Bagnaia was going to start on a hard front and a soft rear. Martin was going with a hard front and a medium rear. The simple math is Martin could be ninth or score 7 more points than Bagnaia, and he will be the world champion. Bagnaia gets off to a great start. Martin's right behind him, followed by Marc Marquez, Bastianini, Acosta, and then Aleix Espargaró. Marc Marquez got by Martin at turn one. Aleix was right on Bastianini, and it was a ding-dong little battle there that those guys kind of go through. But it's really just Bagnaia, Marc Marquez, and Martin out front. And Aleix is Martin's really good friend. He's going to run rear gunner behind him, So you're almost at this point think it's close to being over because really Martin's going to have enough points to win this championship. He just has to ride smart, stay in his lane, not let anything happen. Don't get super aggressive, and he's going to be world champion. Alex got by Acosta for sixth. Mir crashes, but Bastianini was wide at turn one, and then he dropped down to seventh. It's Bagnaia, Marquez, Martin, Aleix, Alex Marquez, and Acosta. That's your top six. They run that way basically to about 7 laps to go. And then Acosta was sliding back as Bastianini and Binder would get by him. Morbidelli would get by Acosta now too. So Acosta ran out of tire or something with the KTM and was having difficulty there. But with five to go, Bagnaia is still in control, still the top three as they were. And Aleix and Alex and Bastianini, two to go. Alex got by Aleix, but as it would finish, Bagnaia wins the race. Marc Marquez was second. Jorge Martin was third, thus giving Martin the championship. Alex Marquez had a great fourth. Aleix Espargaró, Binder, Bastianini, Morbidelli, Bezzecchi, Acosta in 10th, Quartararo, Oliveira, Jack Miller, Johann Zarco, and Maverick Vinales. And with that, Jorge Martin is world champion. He rode around an emotional last lap for Martin. I mean, my gosh, you've worked so hard to get to something like this. I can't imagine the emotion that you would have. However, he stops at a magic black box. And he was in there for what I thought was an insane amount of time. And I thought, if he's coming out with gold leathers on, I am really just turning the TV off right now. I'm not watching any more of this. He did eventually emerge after what seemed to be just an absolutely inordinate amount of time with a Terminator mask on him. And he shot the golden helmet out from a block of ice. Mounted that and took that helmet and rode on into the pit lane for the celebrations that was there. I don't know. I didn't care for that celebration, but Martin, I think, is a worthy world champion. How'd you see it, Rich?
Well, first of all, I had said a week or so ago, or sorry, a couple of shows ago, whenever it was, with Top Rack, who I admire greatly. I mean, I genuinely think he's probably in the top three in the world riders at the minute.
Easily.
These self-indulgent winning celebrations really start doing my head in. I actually went and made myself a cup of tea to get away from all of this rubbish, to be honest with you. I thought, and I'm going to pinch this off Simon Patterson because I thought this was absolutely classic. He made the point that when, as you have just said, Jim, when Hoy re-emerged, it was a bit underwhelming, really. And Simon Patterson said, what would have been truly phenomenal would have been if he'd come out butt naked, ridden round to the Aprilia garage, gone up to Aleix Espargaró, bearing in mind we're talking Terminator, and said, I want your boots, your clothes, and your motorcycle. And sort of, I won't try and do the Arnie impression. But bearing in mind he was going to be taking that over that seat and that bike a couple of days later, that would have been really quite entertaining. And yeah, that one I would have been there for. But I mean, perfect weekend by Bagnaia, but an almost perfect season by Martin. I forget how many races between the sprints and the main races Bagnaia won in the end, but
11, I think.
a lot. And you would think that that should have been enough to win in the championship. But it goes to show, and this is coming from me, I held my hands up. I've never been the, well, since he's been in MotoGP, I mean, I really liked and rated Martin through Moto3 and Moto2. And
Me
then
too.
as we got to sort of see a bit, perhaps a bit more of him, and certainly as I had an encounter with him in Qatar last year, I was not a big fan following that, if I'm honest. But you can certainly see that he has worked on his kind of, I don't want to say attitude, that sounds a bit pompous, but his mental approach, let's put it that way. I mean, he was visibly very, very nervous, as you would fully
Oh, you have
expect,
to
but
be.
he wasn't kind of, he didn't go into this weekend all sort of cocky because he was in a very strong position. He did look genuinely very kind of nervous and was probably riding pretty tight. So the fact that he delivered the results that he did, I thought was, you know, very creditworthy and fair play to the guy. I mean, and this is, as I say, this is coming from me. He is a worthy champion, and to do it on a satellite, I mean, I know it's a works bike, but it wasn't the works team, and he is the first person in the modern era, if not ever, to win a championship on a non-fully works outfit. So, I mean, there's a great deal of credit that's due to him for that. So, yeah, I mean, it was just a he did what he had to do this weekend, didn't he? And it was more than enough in the end. I mean, Bagnaia, as you said earlier, Jim, needed a lot of help, and the cavalry just never arrived.
Yeah, I mean, to me, there was a sort of inevitability
Yeah.
once Bagnaia crashed in the sprint in Malaysia. Like,
Yeah, absolutely.
one too many times on the ground, Bagnaia. And, and you did that in sprints, which is okay. But in those sprints, Martin won. And then in the race on Sunday, you may have won, Pecco, but guess what? Martin was right behind you. And that did him in, right? I mean, he is, yes, the first person to win on in a non-factory team, a privateer team in the MotoGP era, if you want to consider that to be the modern era. But it's not the first time that a satellite team has won a world championship. Kenny Roberts' team back in the 90s with Marlboro was not the factory Yamaha team. They became the factory Yamaha team, but they weren't originally. Eddie Lawson won on a Rothmans Honda in 89 with Irv Kentamoto tuning it. That was not the factory Honda team. It was Irv's team. So it has been done. It just has not been done in the modern four-stroke era. And Martin did it. And more to the point, I am most happy for Pramac, for them as a team. I was very scared. I didn't want it to be a mechanical failure or a problem from one of the guys on the team that caused Martin to not win it. And they didn't. I'm not saying that those guys are incapable of tuning or working on a motorcycle. No, they're fabulous people. All of them are. But you can't help but be caught up in what you're doing, right? But they stuck to their system. They stuck to how they did things. It seemed like the team was always doing the same week after week after week. They obviously were nervous. You could tell from what was going on in the box or whatever, right? But they held together. They did what they had to do, and they won. And it's a deserved championship. I mean, there's no question about it.
And to add to that, Jim, I would also say it's to the very great credit of Ducati that they didn't play any
Yes.
or try to play any silly games. And I personally was, I thought it was very heartwarming to see the Ducati top brass straight into the Pramac garage
Oh,
once
yeah.
once Martin had won the championship and congratulating everybody, you know, because at the end of the day, Ducati did win the Riders' Championship. Yeah, it will stick in their throat a bit that the number one plate potentially goes over onto the Aprilia, but I don't see any great sort of bragging rights for Aprilia on that, having the number one plate on the front of Martin's bike next season, because they didn't win the championship. He did. He's just switched teams. So I think that's all going to play out in a fairly fair-minded way in the end of the day. But as I say, you could have understood, although they were the masters of their own kind of demise in this particular instance, you could have understood it if Ducati had been a bit sour-faced about the way things ended up. But both them and Pecco Bagnaia as well, which is important to point out, he handled himself, I think, with a great deal of dignity and professionalism, which hasn't necessarily always made the wisest choices in other areas of what he does. But no, I thought everybody was pretty exceptional, really. I mean, we're coming to the end of this kind of period of relative stability in terms of riders and teams and stuff, and we'll talk briefly about the test in the moment because we're going into a season next season which is fascinating in all sorts of different ways. I mean, Martin won a lot of races this year, but I forget the actual stat, but I think he only finished off the podium in like three or four races all season long. I mean, it was just a
Yeah, I
fantastic
think so.
run of form, and you know, you could never say, oh, he kind of won it by attrition, because he didn't. He won loads of races. Bagnaia just screwed up one or two times too many at critical moments and was always kind of chasing it. So the right guy won, really, at the end of the day, and that's all you really ever want to be able to say. He wasn't robbed by some finger trouble or a mechanical, because imagine if the bike had blown up or something in the
Oh,
final
yeah.
race.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You know, immediately there'd have been conspiracy that, you know, Ducati had caused it to happen. So it all played out perfectly fair, perfectly level. And whilst I personally maybe would have preferred Bagnaia to win this one last time before Marquez goes on the rip, you know, Jorge Martin is a worthy world champion. And not to say he won't win another championship. I think he's going to be an awful lot better on that Aprilia. I think he's been written off a bit too early for my liking, but I guess we'll come to that now.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think Jorge is an incredible rider. All these guys are incredible riders. For me, I have a personality conflict. I just, neither Bagnaia or Martin do it for me from a personality point of view. From a riding perspective, they're phenomenal. They're amazing. They're great. But they lack that charm, charisma, the quote unquote it factor that some people have.
I don't disagree with you.
I mean, and it's not that they're boring people or whatnot, but I mean, Martin wound up getting involved in some row over a television interview shortly after the world championship, you know? And Bagnaia has had his indiscretions with a drunk driving incident, right? This is not shaming them. We're human beings, and you are entitled to your life and do what you're going to do. However, at some point, especially at this level, you are a more motorcycle racer. You are going to be looked at by millions of people, and they're going to judge you for your actions. All of them, on the racetrack or off the racetrack, rightly or wrongly, that's what's going to happen. And at some point, I mean, it has to be just insanely tough to keep your personal life out of the spotlight and be able to go somewhere and not be recognized in Spain or in Italy or, you know, just simple things. If you want to go out with a date with your wife to a nice restaurant in Italy, then everybody's going to recognize Bagnaia, right? It's got to be difficult.
I'll tell you what it is for me though, Jim. And obviously every rider is different, and I'd be, you know, interested to see if anyone wants to write in and express their opinions on some of this stuff. You know, Bagnaia is very level-headed, and he's obviously a really nice guy. Okay, he's done a couple of silly things, but then who
Who
hasn't?
hasn't?
Yours truly included. But he's almost just like a little bit too nice, a little bit too kind of, I don't know what the word is really, but yeah, just it's a bit neutral to me. It's hard to sort of get really enthusiastic.
Yeah.
Other than the fact that he is an incredibly fast rider, Martin still has, but certainly had that kind of whiff of arrogance about him, and a propensity to sort of lash out at people when things didn't quite go his way. Again, referring back to Qatar last year, which I was at, if you remember, and I had my sort of less than ideal run-in with him. But that was the famous race where, you know, he, let's say he had a bad rear tire and he went off on this rip about, oh, you know, Michelin stealing the championship from him. And I was like, oh, come on, really? I mean, that's so childish to sort of have that kind of reaction to it. And you know, you could say he was understandably upset because things hadn't gone his way, but it was that kind of propensity just to lash out at everybody else, not just take it on the chin. Now, this year he does appear to have turned that bit of his character around, and much credit to him. But what I really like is the Marc Marquez kind of, and I'm not a big Marc Marquez fan historically, but I like that Marquez Acosta, and I think we can start to see bits of it in Alonso, that kind of that killer instinct, you know, the smiling assassin. This was Rossi. I mean, again, remember what that famous journalist said? Don't be fooled by the smile. He'll rip your throat out if he needs to. Those are the kind of love them, hate them, Marmite kind of, as we would say here, characters. They split opinion, but they create a lot of energy around them, you know? They're not boring people at all. You know, my great hope is that, you know, KTM, despite all the worries about KTM in terms of the company at the moment, or the Pierre
Pierre Mobility.
Mobility Group, whatever. Yes,
Yeah,
strange
Pierre
name.
Mobility Group, that's correct.
The hope is that, you know, he can, with a year under his belt, can get at the front. And imagine Acosta and Marquez going at it. As I say, I do firmly believe that Martin will not be languishing down in the middle of the pack next year. I think he'll be close to the front. He might not be right at the front straight away, but we've seen how good that Aprilia is sporadically with Aleix and Vinales. I think with Martin on it, it will be featuring at the front a lot more consistently. So, yeah, I forget how we kind of got onto that.
We were just talking about just Martin's celebration and all that. But
Yes,
I
yeah.
think to sum it up, I think it's this. For the last 4 years, the villain has been missing.
Yeah.
For 4 years, there has been no villain. And I don't think everybody likes things unless there's a villain somewhere in all of this. And the villain's on red now, right? So
Yeah.
let's just look at the championship real quick. Let's then go to testing.
Okay.
So if we go back and we look at the championship, see where everybody else is actually finished off. Martin obviously is now the world champion. Bagnaia was second. Marc Marquez would get the coveted third place in the championship. I mean, given the bike he was riding on, that's pretty doggone good for him. Bastianini, because you know, Marquez beat two factory bikes. He beat Bastianini's factory bike, and he also beat Morbidelli in it too. So Marquez, great to be third in that championship and hit him on a factory bike. Tasty. You gotta think he's gonna be at the front most of the time, if not winning races almost all the time. Bastianini fourth, Bender fifth. He wins the battle of the KTMs, beating Acosta by 2 points to fifth in the championship. Vinales would be seventh, some 25 points behind Acosta. Then Alex Marquez, Morbidelli, and DG Antonio. That's how they finish in the top 10. And that is that. Let's look at testing that happened on that Tuesday. There's not a whole lot that you can take out of this testing. So let's just talk about like where everybody was by time, and then we'll kind of break it down to sort of the more key pieces of it. Or I'll break it into the more key pieces that I see, Rich, and then you can comment on those and tell me if there's any key piece that maybe I've missed in all of this as well.
Yep.
So Alex Marquez set the fastest time in the test, and he said, well, why wouldn't I? I got a 24 bike, and it's a huge improvement over a 23 bike, and I have all the notes and setups, so there was really nothing for me to do but go fast.
Yeah.
Quartararo was second on a Yamaha, still an inline four Yamaha. Then we had Bagnaia on a 25, which it was in white. And I thought that bike just looks so good in white. I just think it does for some reason. Then Marquez Mark fourth on the all red Ducati, all of it red. And it looked so good with the big, like slightly different shade of red 93 on it. That bike looked really super cool. That to me was very special. Paint job looked really great. Then Raul Fernandez on the Trackhouse bike, then Brad Binder, Morbidelli, Rins, then Pedro Acosta, then Zarco, Martin, Vinales, Bezzecchi, Aleix Espargaró on the Honda, Mir, Bastianini, Oliveira, Luca Marini, Miguel Pirro, Audegar, Ayagura, Miller, Somkat Chantra, and Salvadori. Those are the 24 bikes that were on the track. So let's think about this from this standpoint. One, be very afraid of Marc Marquez on a factory Ducati. Be very afraid. Underestimate how bad he wants another championship at your own peril.
Yes.
Okay. Then Bagnaia had nothing to prove. He's been the fastest Ducati rider, one of the fastest Ducati riders for a long time. He was just figuring out the new bike. The new bike seems to be more evolutionary than revolutionary because there doesn't appear to be very much between them. And that was said by Alex Marquez. It was said by a few other people who were now riding 24s versus 25s. The test riders, who was test riding there? Is it Pirro?
Hero,
Was Pirro was test
yeah.
riding. He says, yeah, the bike is not that much faster. It's not as big a jump as what the difference was between a 23 Ducati and a 24 Ducati. The 25 is much closer, but we don't have a lot of setup data on that bike yet. So there is room for it to evolve ever so slightly. You look like you have something you want to interject here, Rich. So please do.
Only to interject with a caveat, which is that
Okay.
the chatter that, you know, I tapped into in terms of reading and listening to things was that there is probably going to be a fairly significant aerodynamic climate update coming on that 25 Ducati. And obviously, they were never going to run it at Barcelona because it would give far too much time for other teams to analyse. So, whilst the 25 bike was certainly an evolution, I think it might go perhaps a wee bit radical. Or is there such a thing as being a wee bit radical? That's an oxymoron. It will probably change a bit more for the, what will it be, Thailand or Malaysia tests when we get to.
Oh gosh, I don't even remember which one's next, Rich, to be honest with you.
Sepang is where they go first, and then they test at
Thailand, and then they race in Thailand. And then they go to Buriram. That is Buriram in Thailand, or is Buriram the one in Indonesia? It
that's
doesn't matter.
Indonesia. I'm pretty sure that's
We will
Indonesia.
figure this all out in
Yeah.
our pre-race shows that we're gonna do between now
The
and then.
interesting thing, though, that Jim, that Pirro said over the course of the weekend, bearing in mind he ran on the VR46 bike, because obviously Fabio Di Giantonio was off again, having had the surgery. And I'm pretty sure that was a 23 bike that he was on. And he couldn't get over how far back it was relative to the 24 bike that he's been used to riding from a testing an occasional wildcard
Makes you
position.
wonder how good Marquez is in that case, right?
That is the point. For Marcus to have done what he has done on that bike really does shine a light on just how potentially devastating he might be next year on a 25.
So some other things that we learned about all this, we learned also that you can say that Jorge Martin adapted very well to the new Aprilia. The crash that he did have on it was not a crash of a rider going, "What the hell just happened here?" It was a crash that a rider has when he's pushing, looking for a lap time and trying to find the limit, and now it's slightly gone beyond it. I do wonder about Aprilia Martin and his new crew chief, because that's all different. That's a lot of change, right? I mean, if he was taking his crew chief with him from Pramac, okay, yeah, maybe not so bad. But you got a crew chief who's learning the bike, he's learning his rider. It's all a little bit up there, right? And I don't know if that's going to be the one little weakness that Martin has, but I do think there will be a more consistent top 10-ish, top 5-ish, maybe Aprilia, and it will be Martin. I think we know that much right there. Acosta says sometimes the KTM does silly things. So again, with the Pierre Mobility Group, I think a lot of people should be talking about the fact that apparently they're not going to produce a motorcycle at all for 2 months or something like that. They're laying off a big chunk of their workforce. The rumor is that Matisse's son, is it Matt or Mark? I don't remember which is. I think it's Matt, but he was willing to offer all kinds of money to the Pierre Mobility Group to get them through this, but they claim that those talks have never taken. The problem is KTM has made their ethos race ready, right? We're ready to race. We're KTM, we're ready to race. We're going to win. They're not going to stop racing per se, right? I'm just worried that you've got this kid in Acosta. You really have to support him with everything, but are they willing to give him everything? I don't know. They may, but I'm not sure. This is a difficult time for KTM. They've got to produce a bike. They have to produce. They have got to have a bike that is at least the equal of the Aprilia, if not close to the Ducati. And it can't fade somewhere. It can't come out of the box and be great and then disappear for the middle of the season and return at the very end. It has to be good the whole time. And I think they need to think about what Acosta wants in a motorcycle and what he feels and how they're going to go about that one. Speaking of developing a motorcycle, I don't ever remember Pecco Bagnaia saying anything about how Bastianini and his riding style were equivalent or that they wanted to go in the same direction with the motorcycle like Marquez and him want to. Now, he's either playing to the media to disenfranchise everybody, or that's really true, and him and Marquez think the same thing of the bike. Now, if that's the case, and you have non-diverging rider styles, if you will, that means the Ducati may be even better than what we think it may be because of the two of them pushing the development. Of course, who knows what kind of crazy gizmo wings and stuff that Dallinia will have. And they're talking about having a 27 bike on track in 25, which kind of makes sense because they said they're only going to have three factory Ducatis. Well, what's going to happen to the people that were making that fourth Ducati? Well, they're making the 2027 Ducati, which that ought to scare everybody that they're
Yes,
going to
it
get that
should.
much testing time on it, right?
Yeah.
The other thing I thought that was interesting that came out of this was the Honda saga, with Juan Mir frustrated that they had nothing to test. Johann Zarco going, dude, sit back and chill. The new stuff's coming, but what we got here is okay to learn and have a direction. And then you have Marini, who's all excited because Aleix was as fast as him on a Honda and said, well, there's really not that much wrong with it. We just got to tweak a few things. Ooh, I have no clue where Honda is in all of this. Between all of that, you got one person who's really mad, one guy who's really happy that they've got Aleix, and another guy's like, ah, just wait for the updates. I don't know. I'm confused, even more so now than I was previously.
It doesn't sound good when you've got different
No.
riders saying different things on the same, ostensibly the same bike, though, does it?
No.
Mir's big beef all season has been,
Lack of testing
well, lack
parts.
of rear grip and extreme chatter. And
Yeah.
apparently, all of those
Acceleration
things,
too, I think, right?
well, yeah,
I guess the chatter is part of it. I guess if it's chatter, you can't
they're
be on
all
the
out all
gas.
over the place. And this has been obviously a problem that we've seen very graphically at times on slow-mos with KTM as
Oh,
well. I
yeah.
mean,
Yep.
since this new rear came in, some teams have really, really struggled.
Oh, who said that the bike was built around that new rear? I can't remember. Somebody said that the bike was built around that new rear tire. Oh, I forget. I didn't write it down in my testing notes. Sorry, guys. I'll figure it out before the next show. Anyway, what else, Rich? Anything else from the MotoGP testing? I mean, you're really not going to learn much from this,
No, it's a
right?
test, particularly this test, because nobody wants to head into the winter with a broken something or other, or
No.
damaged pride or whatever. Although I must add, Bastianini had a mother and father of all crashes on the Tech 3 KTM. Actually, I'll rephrase that. He had the normal turn 5 crash on the KTM, and the bike went and hit the barrier and was literally in pieces. So that was not a great start for him. Vinales did a lot of laps. I made a note somewhere. I highlighted it here. Yeah, I mean, Vinales is 74 laps and apparently was quite pleased and was super impressed with the starting capability of the KTM, which we know it's a great bike in terms of the current kind of start format with electronics and ride height devices and stuff. And we know that Vinales has been an absolutely putridly bad starter on the Aprilia for most of the year, or most of his time there. So there are some interesting things going on. I was particularly impressed with Aguirre, 86 laps on the Trackhouse bike. That was he did the most laps in the day. And again, quietly, quietly, softly, softly, Monster Energy Yamaha continue to look as if they're finding their way forward again in a way that Honda still aren't quite at that point yet. Despite the fact that Aleix Espargaró, again, who's a bit of a Marmite sort of character as far as I'm concerned, but he jumped on that Honda again, white livery looked really awesome.
The white looks good. It really
Was
does,
really
yeah.
quick, straight out of the gates on it.
Yep.
So he may well contribute a lot. There are new technical people involved in some of the teams in terms of KTM and Honda and stuff. So there's just so much to look forward to next year, Jim, as far as I'm concerned, with so many kind of differences. Pramac, Yamaha didn't really sort of show too much, but I mean, that's a huge change for the whole team operationally,
Massive.
with the equipment, and again, none of the riders were going to want to smash stuff up. So nothing jumped out too much, other than the fact that although it was a test, and yes, it was not a big surprise that Alex Marquez was quickest, but his time of 1:38.803 compared with the 1:38.641, which was Bagnaia's pole on the Sunday. So he was going very, very quickly. So the times were quick, even though it was, and there might have been one or two fuzzy heads still knocking around in the pit lane because obviously you had the Grand Gala on the Sunday night. So, but clearly the important test will be the post-Christmas or the into the new year one, which as I say, I think is in Sepang. As to precisely what date that is, I don't know. But we're going to formulate a plan of what we're going to do over this kind of 2.5 months. I mean, it's hardly any time off at all, really. We've got a few things planned, haven't we, Jim? And we'll talk about the new season once we get into the new year and what we're most looking forward to. But there is a huge amount of intrigue there. And that was an interesting day's running.
Yep, it was just interesting there. I think that pretty much covers MotoGP testing
Yeah.
for everything that we can know and think of. So let's talk about the Moto2, Moto3 test. That was at Jerez, right? And it was a private test. So we don't know a lot out of it.
I must divulge at this point, I haven't even seen any of the coverage of the Moto2, Moto3 tests, so I'm in your hands.
Oh, that's okay. I mean, there's not a whole lot there. This was courtesy of David Emmett, Moto Matters. He had posted this on X. It's a private test, but Anshu is the quickest Moto2 guy there at 1:40.6. Then there's Adrian Gutierrez, who's the rookie. He's at a 1:41 flat, which that's pretty good for the rookie. After that, it's Guevara. And then Arbolino, then Colin Vire. So now we're getting into the Moto3 grads, right? So there's Vire. After Vire is Holgado. So Holgado is at 1:41.5. Same thing here with Vire. They're right there with each other. They're like a few hundredths of a second different. And then who else is in that 141 range? Oh, somebody you may have heard of, Rich One, Mr. Alonso.
Wow, okay.
So all three of the technically the fastest Moto 3 kids are all right there, and they're all on the 1 minute 41 and a half range, which is pretty fantastic, quite actually. And then Ortola is right after Alonso, and he's about 3.5 tenths adrift of his compatriots of Moto 3. So pretty well there. And Rueda was the fastest Moto 3 rider there. And then it was Cappare, who was the world junior champion. He had the wild card in Moto 3.
Okay.
And then there's a Maximo, I guess it's Quilis. It's with a Q. I'm not sure how
Okay.
that works in Spanish. I don't know enough Spanish yet. I haven't heard it enough. And then Piqueras, then Ogden, and then Foggia was the slowest of the Moto 3 guys that were out on track at the time. So not a whole lot to get from there. We won't know more until later with all that. So with all that, that's testing. That's everything that we know there. Quickly to kind of talk through a couple of the shows that are upcoming, guys. I have another interview, chat, sit down with Michael Gugis. If you have any questions for Michael, please fire them off, motopod@motopodcast.com. Happy to ask him. This is going to be a long, long, long chat because we're going to go through everything. I've got a list, a laundry list of questions to ask Mike. Oh, and he's really has some good insider paddock knowledge. So if there's anything that you can think of that you want to know, let me know, and I'll be sure that I ask that question of Mike when I talk to him. I'm doing that on December the 7th. We're planning on a review. Rich and I having a review of the season podcast, the interview podcast we'll have after that. Rich, you've got still some Silverstone interviews
Well, I've
to
got
touch up.
quite a lot of Silverstone stuff, actually. I mean, since Silverstone, I went straight on holiday for 2 weeks, which wasn't terribly helpful in that sense. And then we had just like so many races, it was just impossible to shoehorn this stuff in. So obviously, some of the stuff that's been discussed with riders at Silverstone that was unknown at the time is now known. So there's a little bit of, I suppose that's not ideal. But most of what we talk about is great content for the off season when it's a bit quieter. And like you, Jim, I'll encourage some questions in because in principle, I have James Toseland and James Ellison lined up for some Zoom calls over the course of the short winter break, let's call it. Those two guys have enormous kind of CVs to talk about in terms of what they've done in the world of bike racing. I'll hope to have a chat about World Superbikes with Greg Haynes again at some point before that season gets going again. So if anybody has any burning questions that they would like to ask any of those three gents, that would be great. And indeed, if anybody has any riders or team people that they would particularly like us to try and nab next year at some point, because we'll try and get to a few races again, Jim.
Yeah, I got my Texas tickets already,
Cool.
so
Yeah.
we're heading there.
And as you know, Scott obviously delivered up some great content from a couple of the Moto A rounds and the Barber Vintage, which was, that stuff was great. So thanks to Scott for that. There's a couple of other people I might sort of reach out to just to see if they're around to do a couple of things for us next season as well. So loads of content to come. And yeah, we'll try and fill up the relatively quiet period once you've had a slight sort of detox, if that's not the probably not the right word, is it? But it's just been so busy. I mean, it's just a full-on season, isn't it,
Oh
now? We
yeah,
get
it's
so much
crazy.
racing to talk about. So yeah, lots of stuff to get into over the off season before things go crazy again. I was thinking just before we came on air, Jim, we were talking, weren't we? And I was in my mind, I still kind of think of MotoGP getting going sort of March, April time, but no, it's the end of February, you told me, because I've kind of
Yeah.
lost track of the calendar again. So yeah, it's not long to go.
Yeah, we'll have to. I was just trying to think of trying to grab here real quick when the opener is
Just whilst
here.
you're doing that, Jim, I noticed you said on the Moto2 private test that he found Guevara posted the second or third quickest time. So he obviously does have a contract. I just haven't spotted who that team is that he's with. But I'm pleased to see that he does have a ride confirmed. I'm assuming that's with a new team because I don't suppose it would be on the Aspar squad. And just to reconfirm to you, because we're going to see this kid's name quite a bit, Adrian Huertas, who I think you said was
Huertas, okay.
second, he's the World Supersport champion that's come
Oh,
across
okay.
to Moto2. So he is a rookie technically in Moto2, but he comes with, yeah, a fair bit of pedigree.
Yeah, so the first race weekend is February 28th through March 2nd, Grand Prix of Thailand.
Okay, wow, not
And
long.
then from there, we're supposed to go 14th of March to the 16th of March is the Grand Prix in Argentina. Now, we didn't go there last year. I'm willing to bet we're not going there this year again,
Yeah.
but it's on the calendar. But then that means that would be, if that's the case, if we don't go to Argentina, it's a month between the race in Thailand and the race at COTA.
Unless they've got another race that they'll try and slot in
Maybe, who
as a
knows?
substitute, and they're working on that already. But it does seem curious to me that they have kind of Argentina nailed in as a definite round
Yeah.
two, given everything that we know and what you've just said. It seems somewhat hopeful to me.
One thing else, Rich, I need to have your opinion. What do you think of the new MotoGP logo?
Well, again, this one has kind of caused bits of social media to go kind of swivel-eyed bonkers. I actually quite like it, to be honest with you, Jim. I mean, change is as good as a rest, and it's only a logo at the end of the day. It's nothing to get too hot under the collar about. I don't know if you've been following the news of Jaguar Land Rover in the UK in the last few days. They've kind
I
of come
can't,
out with a new
no, I have
marketing
not.
campaign, which has gone down about as well as a turd in a swimming pool. These roads are fraught with danger. As it stands, the MotoGP logo, I don't think it's offensive in any way. They haven't kind of, do I go down this avenue? They haven't kind of overcomplicated it by saying that it's anything other than a logo. They haven't tried to sort of push some agenda, some kind of virtue signaling add-on to the whole thing. It's just purely a slight rebrand. You would assume with the future and liberty perhaps somewhat in mind. I mean, I'm not a marketeer, so some of the relevance of this stuff is a little bit lost on me, but I quite like the look of it. And as I say, they haven't overcomplicated it by delivering other messages which are nothing to do with bike racing. So for that, I'm eternally grateful, particularly when you look at what Bud Light, Target, is it? The whole go
Yeah, oh
woke, go
boy.
broke thing. Again, I don't want to encourage too much negativity onto the show, although I'm sure a lot of people will be like-minded. But if you start to go down avenues and rabbit holes about stuff that's not core to your brand or your audience, more pertinently, then down that road ruin lies. So for me, we've escaped with just a slightly different logo, and that's good enough for me at this point.
I don't think it's hideous by any means. I do like the fact that now, like, the microphones and stuff say MGP, which I think is easier to kind of grab because it's like, it's like M2, it's Moto 2, right? M3 and Moto 3. Now it's MGP. To me, though, the way they styled the M is very reminiscent of how Formula One is styled F1 in the Liberty era. So I think this is the first big influence of Liberty trying to sneak into this. I think. I don't know that for certain, but.
Either the enlightened or the doomsdayers, depending on which side of the fence you want to sort of occupy, might infer from some of that some closer integration between what MotoGP and Formula One actually do.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
I say that with no speculation in mind, but the fact that they're kind of aligning the brand identity, as marketeers would say, get me.
The buzzword there.
Yeah, probably isn't a coincidence, but as to exactly what that means going forward, only time will tell, really.
Yep. I don't think it's hideous, but one thing that I didn't like about the Formula One rebrand and their logo was that their website, they created their own font to go with that logo, which I thought was hard to read. And I mean, I have reading issues, but that's me. And at least they didn't change the font to try to have every M look like the MotoGP M everywhere. I would have really lost it there. I mean, it's in there a little bit, but it doesn't have as much lean angle to it. So it's much easier to realize that that's an M and that's an N than the way it was to try to figure out A's in Formula One thing. But anyway, that's everything that I have, Rich, to talk about.
End of a fascinated season. Not bucket load of great racing in the MotoGP format, I think it must be said. There were certainly some good races and some good individual performances. Moto3, again, was the standout class, really, with an utter standout rider. Moto2 delivered up some very good races on occasion, much better than we've seen in the past. And yeah, MotoGP, it's a bit of a waiting game, really, I think, at this point, for the 27 rule set to come about, when things will shake up really properly. But we do at least have all these other changes with teams and riders and a couple of, manufacturer swaps and stuff, or one anyway, going on next year to keep our attention and to sort of rough things up a little bit in terms of form and so on. So yeah, there's a great deal to look forward to. But yeah, the end of a great season, the ditto World Superbike, which arguably has been a lot better in terms of the racing than MotoGP, but it is production racing, and I'll always caveat that. So and a great BSB season, a very entertaining Moto America season with Josh Herron taking the title on the Ducati. So everywhere we look, it's been really, really good. I guess there's probably been one or two nasty accidents, one or two tragedies here and there, but generally speaking, it's been an okay year. The TT went off, without any major incidents this year, which was great. The future of road racing, I mean, Macau was a bit of an unmitigated disaster. I don't know if you caught any of that over the weekend just gone, Jim.
Yeah, I heard something about they couldn't, the cars had caused a problem to where they really had like almost no motorcycle practice at all
Yeah.
or something.
And then to cap it all off, it was torrential rain on race day, and so the bike race never happened, and so the trophies were handed out based on qualifying, which itself was a bit of a disaster, really. So I feel very sorry for all the teams and riders and so on. That great expense, it must be said, go all the way out to Macau for something that is really, I think, almost unviable, really, going forward now, because of the amount of stoppages they have, because it's a car weekend, really, and it's such a tight, snarly little place that there's just constant red flags, and the bikes always just get kicked out of the order of the run-in. So, and this was the big beef this year. So I think Macau might be something that we don't really see much involvement in years to come. But at least Northwest 200 and the TT on the Isle of Man, strength to strength, improving safety all the time. And yeah, looking forward to seeing those things again. I mean, we've got to try and get there one year, Jim, you and I, haven't
We
we?
have to, yeah. It's a bucket list.
Yeah. So I'm still plugging away, by the way. I was up at the NEC in Birmingham, the National Exhibition Centre, for the motorcycle live show. So I went up, spent the whole day shamelessly grifting, handing out a kind of motopod prospectus to various commercial entities there in the hope that somebody might come along and jump onto the show and help us out a little bit to realise some of our loftier dreams and ambitions. But we do, for the time being, still rely on our very loyal listeners and those people that subscribe on a financial basis to the show. They're absolutely invaluable, Jim. So we can never say thank you enough to those guys, and hopefully they'll continue to stay along for the ride and like this trajectory that we're on with race attendances and interviews and all the extra stuff that we do outside of just talking about the races. So yeah, end of a busy year, and much to look forward to going into 2025.
All right, people, ride safe.
Yep, and we will well, we'll be in touch fairly shortly, but yeah, everybody's probably looking forward to a bit of a rest and recuperation. So enjoy the R&R.